Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. With its uncanny night howls, unrivaled ingenuity, and amazing resilience, the coyote is the stuff of legends. In Indian folktales, it often appears as a deceptive trickster or a sly genius. But legends don't come close to capturing the incredible survival story of the coyote. As soon as Americans began ranching and herding in the West, they began working to destroy the coyote. Despite campaigns of annihilation employing poisons, gases, helicopters, and engineered epidemics, coyotes didn't just survive, they thrived, expanding across the continent from Anchorage, Alaska to Central Park. In the war between the humans and the coyotes, coyotes have won, hands down. This morning we talk with Dan Flores, author of Coyote America, about the long and twisted natural history of the coyote in North America and why the coyote, unlike the gray wolf, has beat back a century of eradication efforts. Dan is the A.B. Hammond Professor Emeritus of Western History at the University of Montana and the author of 10 books on aspects of Western U.S. history. Dan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Barbara, I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. I really enjoy reading your book, though parts of it were rather hard to take, and we'll get to that in this interview. I wanted to start by asking you why, in the introduction, you refer to the coyote as an American avatar.
Well, as I was working on this book, it occurred to me that coyotes and human beings not only have an extraordinary number of evolutionary adaptations in common, and are also both pretty recent species on the Earth, in some ways almost competitor species, but that at various times in history, we seem to have understood that, and so we've made them into kind of stand-ins in the world for us. And the two primary ways that's happened are among Native people with the coyote stories that are, of course, are the oldest literature of North America, and also more recently and kind of more whimsically, the Roadrunner coyote cartoon figures, which introduced a coyote who became kind of everybody in America's best friend during the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
So what does that mean? I mean, how do coyotes reflect ourselves back to ourselves?
Well, I think it's no accident, for example, that the first animal that we domesticated as humans was a canid. And that's in part because we recognize them so readily in the world. I mean, they're social animals like ourselves. Canids have to raise their young over an extended period of time in order to teach them the culture that they need to survive in the world. They tend to mate monogamously, have pair bonds that, if the animals live long enough, last through life. And so there are a lot of natural history particulars that I think we sort of intrinsically see as having in common between ourselves and canids. But in the case of coyotes, I mean, it kind of goes farther than that, because this is an animal that we recognized a very long time ago in America survives by its wits, by its intelligence. And that was something I think that we saw as profound, as interesting, and as a valuable thing. And so we looked at them as kind of stand-ins in the world, which is basically what an avatar is in modern computing. It's a stand-in for the person at the keyboard. We've looked at them that way. And so that was a metaphor that occurred to me as I began doing this research, and I found it in all kinds of places.
Well, it also struck me, you referred to both humans and coyotes as cosmopolitan creatures. And what does that mean?
Well, we're both, for instance, animals that emerge from particular parts of the world. In the case of us, of course, we came out of Africa and then spread around the globe and came out of basically a semi-tropical setting, which, as I argue in the book, is why we set our thermostats at 72 degrees, no matter whether we live in Edmonton or in Tucson. Everybody has a particular comfortable kind of level that has to do with where we evolved on the planet. Coyotes came out of the southwest of the United States and or of North America, They evolved about 5.3 million years ago, and although they haven't spread around the world, other canids have, coyotes have remained in North America, but they've become this animal, especially in the last few hundred years, that has left the desert southwest for every kind of ecological setting you can imagine. I mean, they're found from the tundra along the Arctic Circle all the way down to Central American jungles in places like Guatemala and Costa Rica. And so they're like us. They're animals that have been able to figure out how to live in a variety of different places and do it successfully.
Even without air conditioning or central heating.
Yeah. Well, we had to introduce those kinds of things along with sewn clothing and living in houses and so forth to live in all the cosmopolitan places that we've basically colonized over the last 40 or 50,000 years. But coyotes do it, as you said, without having air conditioning, without having heating systems. They figured out, they're smart enough to work out a way of existing in all of these different kinds of habitats. And that's kind of unusual among mammals.
Well, I think about the great difference in the way that I perceived coyotes, let's say 50 years ago, and the way I think society, at least in North America, has then and now. I mean, when I was a kid, coyotes were a wild. I didn't really distinguish that much between coyotes and wolves, actually, because I grew up in New England, and what did I know about any of these wild canids? But they seemed to be these wild creatures of the West, basically. And I knew that wolves were more or less extinct at that point, but coyotes were still alive, and they were out there in the West. And then when I came to the West, there were the coyotes, but they were actually creatures that I would hear yipping and yapping late at night when I was living up near Mount Hood and when I'd be camping. And there was just this real sense of wildness about them and kind of an excitement. It's a little different now that they're my neighbors in Portland. And I wanted to talk a bit about that sort of transformation and how what it means to have these animals, that which really are wild animals, living so in such close proximity to us in cities now.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating thing to experience in the modern world. I'm totally just kind of blown away by the fact that we get to go about our business living in cities and suburbs and get this animal from not only wild America, but from ancient America that is now trotting through our backyards and down suburban streets, and it's happening all over the country. I mean, that's the reason I titled the book the way that I did, because it's happening now in your natal region of New England, just as it's happening in the Southwest where these animals originally evolved, and all the way up into the Pacific Northwest too. So it's a remarkable thing to have happening around us, kind of one of the epic wildlife, to me, the epic wildlife story of our time.
Well, actually, there's been coyotes in the Portland area for quite a while. I mean, probably notably for probably about 20 years at least or more.
Yeah.
But I live in a neighborhood that actually has a pretty expansive wildlife refuge wetland. It's right at the end of our block. And it's 170 acres, so it's a pretty contained area. And when I first moved to the neighborhood, there were beaver there, and there were lots of small rodents and lots of birds, but there weren't any large mammals. And then the deer came. And they came about, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago. And there's actually, I think, a small herd of deer that I haven't seen them recently, but they are definitely there. And so I wondered about when the coyotes were going to come next, because there were coyotes across the river and there were coyotes not that far in other parts of the town. But one day I saw a femur in the park that's above the wetland, and I was trying to figure out what it was, and it occurred to me that it was probably a deer femur, and it had probably been brought up there by a coyote. So that was the first sign for me that there were coyotes there. And then that year, I started seeing more and more signs, and finally saw my first coyote down there. Then I started hearing them yipping at night and coming up into the neighborhood. So it was my sense at the time was I thought this is such a small natural area that it really couldn't support probably either deer or coyote. It's interesting to see that they're supporting each other, and probably the coyote are partly living off the deer as well as the nutria and other wildlife there. And so I wonder about these kind of pressures and how you see how this is transforming the ecology of cities.
Well, you know, one of the things that we thought when we moved into cities 5,000 years ago was that we were going to be getting away from predators. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I think people were drawn to cities, is that it was an escape from the predatory world that lay out in the countryside and in the wild. And so coyotes are, at least in North America, sort of giving the lie to that in, over the last 40 or 50 years. I mean, I think, you know, what's happening is that there are some species out there. I mean, there are many others. Grizzly bears, for example, do not tolerate human activity very well. Wolves, in fact, don't tolerate human activity very well. But there are some species out there. And coyote has been one that's been sort of honing its ability to do this for probably 15,000 years, ever since there have been humans in North America. Some of them do this very well. And one of the reasons coyotes are drawn to being around us, I mean, I think they took our measure a long time ago and decided that we were relatively harmless. And they also are drawn to the kind of ecologies that we create wherever we live. And part of that ecology is that we generate large numbers of mice and rats. Those rodents are drawn to human houses, to settlements, to cities, and that's the coyote's primary prey. And so I think, you know, the reason they've been drawn to living amongst us, and even 1,000 years ago, living in Indian villages in the Southwest and in central Mexico, is because they have figured out how to do it. They don't really fear us very much, and our inhabitations draw the prey that they're really drawn to.
Well, it's interesting because cats, actually, I understand, at least one of the theories, that the way they got domesticated was they started hanging out at granaries, particularly in Egypt, where there were a lot of mice and rats. And they figured out that humans were generating these mice and rats, but they went one step further and allowed themselves to be domesticated. I wonder, do you have any thoughts about why cats got domesticated but coyotes didn't?
Well, the theories on domestication in the last 20 or so years have sort of run in the direction of the animals that we domesticated basically sought domestication. And I think that's the distinction that I see between animals like, for example, at least some wolves that that became domesticated, and cats as well, is that they sought domestication. They allowed themselves to be domesticated because they saw the living to be pretty easy if they were the consorts of human beings. But coyotes have, they've never been animals that humans have been able to domesticate with any degree of success. And I think it has something to do, it's probably not, certainly not a conscious thought in the coyote mind, but it has something to do with the fact that they know they can be among us, sort of in our midst, and reap all the benefits without having to give up their freedom. And so coyotes are just one of those animals that have never sought domestication.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Flores, who's just written a book called Coyote America, about the long and twisted natural history of the coyote in North America. He calls it a natural and supernatural history. So why is it supernatural as well as natural?
Well, as you know from reading the book, I open, after an introduction, the first chapter is called Old Man America. And that chapter is about this canon of literature that was handed down to us through oral means, as an oral literature, probably over about 10,000 years, that constitutes not only the oldest literature from North America, but a very large body of it. And what it's about is a figure that Indian people in the American West, 10,000 years or so ago, designated as a deity figure. And that deity figure, he's a Paleolithic deity, very distinctive from, say, a Jesus figure, because the coyote deity is not this perfect figure whom you're supposed to emulate. He's a figure who sort of possesses all the traits, good and bad, of humans. And his real role in the stories, I mean, we've often referred to him as a trickster, but it seems to me what his role in this body of stories really is to demonstrate human nature. And so I open the book by basically describing how, from the Indian accounts, Coyote created North America, made the rivers flow the way they did, threw the stars into the sky, put people in various places. And then he began having a series of adventures because he didn't want to hide himself from humans. He wanted to enjoy what he had done. He began having a series of adventures among human beings that are intended, in my reading of them, to display human nature. And so those stories are often, they have what one would call in cause-effect terms, not scientific conclusions, but often supernatural ones. So I thought that those stories were important enough that the book ought to give some credence to them in the subtitle, hence the supernatural history of the coyote.
Well, you say that the coyote like to live among people. They figured out that they can. There's a lot of benefits to be reaped, and we're not that much of a threat. However, for over 100 years, and it's probably still going on to some degree today, there's been a great effort to wipe out the coyotes in North America. So if humans are not that dangerous to coyotes, I wonder what their perception was when they were watching so many of their brethren being wiped out.
Well, I mean, we were able to teach them in fairly short order that they had to be wary of us. But, I mean, this is an anomaly in the history of these animals because they've gone for 15,000 years with humans basically not really bothering them at all. And suddenly, starting in the 19th century, about 125, 135 years ago, coyotes first sort of came to the notice of Anglo-Americans as this animal that they didn't know what it was. They had no experience with animals like this in Europe. And so we called it the prairie wolf for a lot of the 19th century, and almost its only function in the 19th century came during the fur trade when those animals were killed by the hundreds of thousands for their pelts. Really, after Mark Twain wrote his great classic, Roughing It, in the early 1870s, and described coyotes as these despicable little vermin that were slinking around with this wretched and cowardly nature. I mean, it gave Americans for the first time a way of looking at this animal that we hadn't had before. And because this happened simultaneously with the beginning of stock raising, especially sheep raising in the American West, the livestock industry, which, of course, is trying to get rid of wolves, began to argue that coyotes were an arch predator as well. So what ensued after wolves were mostly wiped out in the West was this rather extraordinary period that starts with the Animal Damage Control Act of 1931, where Congress appropriates $10 million for a government agency called the Biological Survey to completely exterminate coyotes in North America. And so you have this period that goes from 1931 to 1972, and as you mentioned, to a certain extent still goes on, where we invented device after device, poison after poison, with the goal of completely committing species genocide. We were going to wipe them totally off the face of the continent. And what we had to conclude by the 1960s and the early 1970s is that no amount of pressure was able to reduce the population of these animals. In fact, it did exactly the opposite. What it did was to send them into a colonization mode and scatter them across the entire continent, which is why we now have coyotes in New York City and Boston and Chicago and everywhere else.
So why was it so easy to extirpate the wolves and so difficult to wipe out the coyotes?
Well, there seem to have been a couple of reasons for it, and the primary one had to do with the fact that wolves are purely social animals. They live in packs, and what the hunters of the Biological Survey and state trappers as well, because most states had versions of this same kind of program, what they discovered is that if you could trap or kill one member of a wolf pack, you could use the scent from that animal and in short order catch every single animal in the pack. But because of the pack cohesion, those animals would be drawn to a missing member, and so wolf packs could be wiped out as soon as you caught one. Coyotes, however, this is another way that they mimic our own evolution. They have an adaptive strategy called fission fusion, which means that while they can live as a fusion group, as a social group, and can do things like hunt deer as a pack, whenever they're pressured, they tend to go into what's called a fission mode, which sends them scattered in singles and pairs across the landscape. So in other words, whenever a member of their pack is killed, they don't respond to it by all being killed one after the other. It instead sends them into this kind of fission mode where they scatter. And as I mentioned, it's something that we human beings, we're one of the other few species in the world that also has this same ability. We've had to call on that a couple of times in our long evolutionary history, usually from disease epidemics. But coyotes managed to do this in a way that not only kept them from being wiped out, but it also scattered them and sent them colonizing and into new places. And so it became a story that was entirely different from the outcome of the story of the campaign against wolves.
Well, the other issue, too, was, isn't it true that once the wolves were extirpated, that it gave coyotes more territory to move around in?
It did, because especially gray wolves are longtime enemies of coyotes. And so when gray wolves were extirpated in the West, of course, that opened up resources in the West for a larger coyote population. And as we began eliminating wolves east of the Mississippi River, the red wolf of the South and the Eastern Seaboard, for example, and also the eastern wolf of eastern Canada and northern New England, as those animals were drawn down to just a fragment of their former populations, that also opened up the possibility for a mid-sized predator to take over the role of wolves in the eastern forest. And so there was, you're right, not just a push from this pressure in the West, but also a pull effect that drew coyotes into the East.
I wonder if, as the wolf rehabilitation continues in the West, and we now have a growing number of wolf packs in Oregon, though there's a lot of opposition to them in eastern Oregon still, but if wolves start establishing themselves on the west side of the Cascades, I wonder if that would just drive more coyotes into Portland.
Well, it might indeed drive more of them into Portland, because coyotes have, I think, figured out that living in the city is the good life. I mean, a coyote in the rural West has an average lifespan of about 2.5 years, primarily because it gets shot or somebody traps it, or in some way human beings bring about an early death. But coyotes living in the cities, we know from the biologists who are studying them there, often live to 11, 12, 13 years old. And they also raise their litters. They're able to get more of their pups to survive in the cities. So it may well be that as wolf numbers rise in eastern Oregon, that Portland and Seattle will end up with more coyotes. Certainly the number of coyotes in the rural countryside in eastern Oregon is going to go down. That's what happened in Yellowstone Park when we reintroduced gray wolves there in the middle 1990s. The number of coyotes dropped by close to 50% as a result of the introduction of wolves.
And I would think that actually that would be good for the sheep farmers. You'd rather have wolves around than coyotes, it seems.
Well, yeah, that may be. I mean, the sheep people obviously are the primary cooperators with the government agency that inherited the task of fighting the war against predators. It's now called Wildlife Services. And it still is there. It kills, despite that innocuous name for it. Wildlife Services makes you sound like this is who you call when you want pink flamingos in the yard or something. But actually, this is an agency that has one constituency, and it's the sheep industry. And on behalf of that industry, they kill something like 80,000 coyotes a year, mostly really by flying them down with airplanes and helicopters.
Well, actually, the name Wildlife Services has come up recently in this region because there's a campaign against cormorants now, and particularly at the mouth of the Columbia River, because they're perceived as being the reason why salmon populations have dropped. They don't want to look at the dams and other other issues that people have created to destroy habitat. So in the last year, Wildlife Services has, in fact, they crashed a colony of cormorants on East Sand Island in the Columbia River right near the mouth. And then they wondered, you know, they backed off a little bit because they hadn't intended to do that much harm to the colony. But it seems that that mentality is still there, that we want to blame our difficulties, whether it's the predation of sheep or whether it's just kind of a fear of predators or whether it's not wanting to look at our own follies in terms of how we've transformed landscapes so they can't support natural systems anymore. So we'll blame them on these vermin species. And the coyotes is a good example of that. But I wonder if you see any comparison between cormorants and coyotes as far as being the latest demon.
Well, I think you're exactly right about how we've tended to lay the blame elsewhere. We don't seem to be very introspective about ourselves and our motives and the things we've done, and so we tend to kind of look for something else that's out there that's external to our own lives to blame. And I think, although I don't know this comment story, you're telling me something new, but my guess is that cormorants and coyotes and a whole host of other species, urban raccoons and skunks and so forth, it's fairly easy to look out into the world, which I think we Euro-Americans have tended to do with North America, and sort of think, okay, if we were doing this, I mean, we would weed this place properly. You know, it seemed to go for a long time without being properly weeded, and so what we're going to do now that we're here is to weed it. And things like cormorants and coyotes are good targets for that.
Well, actually, it's kind of funny because when the settlers first came to the Northwest, I guess probably most of the United States, but definitely the Northwest, they thought, this place looks like a great park. And and God has made this great park in the Northwest. And of course, it was the Native Americans who were basically weeding it for millennia. Yeah. So I guess it depends on what you're choosing to weed. And this seems to me, it shows a big difference between the white settlers and Native Americans in terms of their relationship with coyotes.
Well, I think that comes clear very readily in reading the book. What you have on the one hand is an example of people who go for 15,000 years with coyotes living all around them, no doubt living in their villages or at least on the edges of the villages as close as they could get without Indian dogs chasing them away. As far as I was able to discover in my research, I mean, I actually came up with no examples of any instances where Indian people harmed, pursued, or killed coyotes. I mean, there were instances certainly where people would wear their pelts, and so they clearly had to acquire them in some fashion. But beyond that, just nothing like the kind of war that we seemed so readily to embrace against these animals once we were on the scene. But those two different examples stand pretty stock clear in the book, I think. For coyotes, I mean, I've tried to imagine, in fact, and when I was writing this, I tried to do a lot of it from what I would think would be the perspective of the animals themselves. I mean, this had to have been some sort of absolute shock for two or three generations of coyotes to go from being around people who never harmed them to suddenly be the targets of fur and poisoning campaigns that, I mean, eventually just kind of became the scorched earth attempt to totally eradicate them.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Flores, who's author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. I'd like to talk for the rest of the time about our living with coyotes in our cities, because that's something that Americans across the country and probably people across the continent are learning to deal with or not learning to deal with. And as sort of an example of the difficulty, when the coyotes started appearing in the wildlife refuge in my neighborhood, I had conversations with various cat owners who were letting their cats out. One of the effects it had on us is our cats no longer are free-roaming cats, which is actually very good for the songbirds. But a lot of my neighbors still let their cats out. And I had a conversation with this one neighbor at the end of the street who lives very close to the wetland. And he said, well, he didn't understand why the city wasn't going to go in there and trap out the coyotes, because how can you have these coyotes threatening the cats? And I tried to explain to him why that wasn't going to happen and why it shouldn't happen. But I could see that he just saw it in terms of his cat versus the coyotes, which is not that much different from a sheep farmer.
Well, what we're going to have to do is to accept, first of all, that resistance is futile. The coyotes are here. What we know about them biologically now is that no amount of killing them or removing them is going to have any impact on their populations. Their populations are going to be governed by the resources that are out there, and that's true in urban places just as it is in the rural countryside. I mean, in fact, the biologists finally discovered in the 1960s that you can take out 70% of a local coyote population year after year after year, and it doesn't diminish the total number of animals by the end of the following summer. And so, first of all, as I said, resistance is futile. We're going to have to learn to live with them, because this happens to be one of those aspects of nature that, unlike so much of the natural world, we can't just walk out and fix with some technology. And the other thing is, I mean, it's the logical step that proceeds from accepting that these animals are here is that you learn how to coexist with them. They're very good at doing this. They've been living around people for 1,000 years. So what we've got to do is to figure out how to do it as well ourselves. And one of the things it means is some changes in our behaviors, especially with regards to our pets. I mean, we can't really let cats roam around, especially at night. Coyotes aren't really eating cats, but what the reason they're killing them is because they regard them as intra-guild competitor predators in their territories. And so whenever they see a cat, they're not thinking of it as a meal so much as this is a competitor that I need to take out that's invaded my space. So we need to keep our cats up. As you mentioned earlier, that's going to mean we get to hear a lot more bird song in cities than we've been used to hearing for the last 40 or 50 years. We have to do the same thing with dogs. You can't really let, especially small dogs, stay out at night, especially roam around at night, because coyotes are going to react to them in the same way. And whenever you, especially in the spring and summer season, when coyotes are raising their pups, this is when people with dogs in cities get into trouble with coyotes. You need to have your dog on a leash, and if you encounter a coyote that is acting aggressive towards your dog, or it's not retreating, what that usually means is that that animal has a den with pups somewhere in the vicinity. And what you need to do, and I provide an account of my own experience with my dog in doing this, is you turn around and you leave. You abandon the area, let the coyote finish raising its pups, getting them up into the late summer, and at that point, they'll scatter out across the countryside, and you don't have that sort of encounter anymore. But it's just a way of learning how to be with these animals.
Well, actually, I learned a lesson from my dog. The first time I ran into a coyote down in the wetland, we were out deep in the wetland, and I was heading back to the main trail, and my dog just stopped and wouldn't follow me, and she stopped probably for close to 5 minutes. Maybe not that long, but it seemed like an interminable amount of time. I finally get her to come with me, and as we are within view of the trail, we see this coyote walking down the trail. And I'm pretty sure that my dog sensed that coyote was up there and decided, I don't want to mess with this critter.
Yeah, well, your dog had its instincts were correct on that. You don't want, I mean, you know, so there are people, coyotes have been in some cities like Los Angeles for 75, 80 years. In fact, probably since the founding of Los Angeles, they've been there, but we know they were certainly there in the 1920s. And I mean, there were people getting bitten by coyotes in Los Angeles back in the 1980s and 1990s, but it almost always happened when they tried to intervene between their dog and a coyote. And without understanding something about coyote natural history, about the time of the year when they're defending their dens and their pups, I mean, people were just sort of blindly walking into these episodes where their dogs and coyotes would tangle and then run in and try to separate them and end up getting bitten. I mean, the other example that Los Angeles has given us as and wildlife coyote managers all over the United States are attempting to avoid the L.A. experience of the 1980s and 1990s is that people began feeding coyotes in their yards, I mean, which is exactly the wrong thing you want to do. I mean, you definitely do not want to be luring these animals into your yard by giving them handouts, because it habituates them to thinking of humans as a source of food. People end up getting bitten. Coyotes will run through a yard and snap at somebody sitting in a lawn chair because they haven't put out the food for the day. So wildlife managers all over the country, in our cities especially, have been cautioning. The prime directive to people about coexisting with coyotes is that you do not feed them. You do not leave dog food out at night, for example.
Or cat food.
or cat food, anything like that. You want them to remain wild animals, pursuing wild prey, not eating human food in any way. And, I mean, speaking of keeping them wild animals, I mean, what you want to do if you see one that doesn't retreat from you, and most of them will turn and lope away, but if one doesn't retreat, I mean, you want to make sure that you throw a rock at it, you raise your hands and shout at it, you try to keep it being a wild animal, a wild predator in the midst of humans. Otherwise, they can become too nonchalant about being too close to us.
Well, as you're talking about this, I had this image of the famous coyote on the MAX train here in Portland at the airport.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually pulled it up last night to take a look again at that photo. And it is an adorable looking coyote curled up on the seat. So I guess one question is, how did the coyote get up the nerve to get on a MAX train? And what's the proper response if you run into a coyote on a MAX train?
You know, that particular coyote, I've got that photograph in the book too. That particular coyote was actually being chased off the runways at the airport, and it sought refuge in the MAX train. And so it wasn't actually boarding up and you know, taking a ride downtown or anything. It was fleeing from people who were chasing it. I think that, you know, we've had all sorts of incidents like this over the last 15 years in cities. I mean, there was a coyote in Chicago a few years ago that walked into a Quiznos sandwich shop during the middle of a heat wave and hopped up on a cooler in order to cool off, which, of course, immediately had the effect of evacuating the entire sandwich shop. Everybody was gathered around on the street looking in the windows while this coyote kind of commandeered the store inside. And, of course, again, they had to call some animal control people to come in and catch it and take it out. So, I mean, we're having things like this happen. I think the thing to do whenever you see something like this is to keep your distance, pull out your phone, take a photograph of it, send it out with the hashtag Coyote America, because we're accumulating thousands of photographs like this of these animals in our right in our midst now.
Well, one last thing, and this is not such a cute story, but you end your book by talking about the young woman musician who was killed by a coyote in, is it New Brunswick?
Yes.
And yeah. There it raises a kind of a fearful specter, that of the hybrid wolf-coyote dog. So I just wonder if you could, is that actually something that they have decided exists, or is this just another urban legend?
No, we think these animals exist. I mean, what's happened as coyotes have spread into the east is that they have encountered some remnant wolf populations, especially in eastern Canada. And these animals, these wolves, are not the gray wolves of the west. This is a wolf species like the southern red wolf that never left North America. And so it's a very close relative of coyotes, and close enough, in fact, that coyotes and eastern wolves and red wolves can interbreed and create a hybrid animal. And along the way, both wolves, eastern wolves, and coyotes have interbred with dogs. And so we are getting an animal, some people call it the coy wolf, others the eastern coyote, that's a little bit bigger than a western coyote, has some wolf genes, has some dog genes, and it's the dog genes that worry some of these researchers, because dogs tend to be a lot more aggressive about people than any of the wild canids do. We don't really know what happened in this incident where this young woman, and she was an adult, she was 19 years old, got killed by a pack of these animals. But I will say one thing, it's an anomaly in all of American history. I mean, there's no other example of an adult human being being attacked and killed by coyotes anywhere in the history of the continent. So this is an anomalous thing, but it did happen. It happened in 2009, and no one has quite figured out exactly why it happened. She was alone. No one knows whether she ran or there was something about the noise that she was making that attracted these animals. No one knows exactly what happened, except they found a 42-pound male standing over her and growling when the park personnel showed up and found her lying there.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to end. But I hope that we all enjoy our future coyote encounters. And if you want to learn more about coyotes in America, I highly recommend reading Dan's book, Coyote America, and you can maybe come to understand better these new neighbors you have in your neighborhood. So thanks a lot for joining us, Dan.
Oh, you bet. It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Dan Flores, author of Coyote America, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. I'll be gone next week and back on August 1st when my guest is Lori Kaplan, one of the leaders of the movement that stopped LNG in Clatsop County. My engineer is Natasha Delapie, and I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robbie Roberts. And thanks for listening.